Parshas Matos begins with the subject of Nedarim, and there's a good few psukim delineating the details. And as we know, a central feature of the area called Nedarim is the concept that a neder can be revoked. A neder can be undone. As we know, one goes to the Beis Din, or it's actually possible even for one person, if he's what's called a yochid mumcha, an expert in these matters, and he can undo the neder. But the more common application is to petition a Beis Din of three, and the way that one achieves, or at least presents the input for a hatara, for an annulment, is either to register charata, regret, that is to say, sincere regret ever having made the neder. It's not enough to regret that I still have the neder, I regret I ever made the neder, charata, or alternatively, some are a little bit more demanding and require what's called a petach. A petach, literally an opening, meaning a development, a hitpatchut, something that developed in between the time that I made the neder and now, that had I been aware of it, that development would occur when I made the neder, I never would have made the neder. That's a little bit more sophisticated. And the halacha nonetheless is that charata alone is enough to register sincere regret, and the Beis Din can nullify the vow. Our closest exposure to Hataras Nedarim, barring a unique situation, an individual situation, is once a year, possibly twice a year, originally on Kol Nidrei, which is essentially, or initially, a form of Hataras Nedarim. We say it in Aramaic, but if you read the English, it's essentially coming to nullify vows. Kol Nidrei, all Nedarim, etc. Bechulahon, Icharatna Behon, we regret having made them. Kulahon Yehoshirin, Yon Sharon should be permitted. Later on, there was an added institution of doing a Hatara on Erev Rosh Hashanah, which is a somewhat more elaborate form and more a specific form of Hataras Nedarim, which people do after Shacharis. But the original Hatara was in the Kol Nidre. Okay. There is a very interesting statement made by the Mishnah with regard to Hataras Nedarim. The Mishnah states in Maseches Chagiga, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, Heter Nedarim Porchim Ba'avir. The idea of nullifying a vow, literally Porchim Ba'avir, is suspended in the air. What does that mean, it's suspended in the air? It means that there is no basis or a firm link in Torah Shebichtav from where it is derived. Rather, it is a Kabbalah, it is a tradition, Halacha L'Moshe Misinai. It's part of Torah Shebal Peh. If you read the Pasuk, you're not going to see Hataras Nedarim. You'll see plenty of Nedarim. You won't see much Hataras Nedarim. There's a lot of talk, by the way, in the Parsha about a husband or a father revoking the vows of their wife or their daughter. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a Beis Din nullifying the vow being petitioned by the individual in question. That is Porchim Ba'avir. It is pure Torah Shebal Peh. Why is that so? The Gemara explains there in Maseches Chagiga that the basis, if we would call it a basis, for nullifying vows, is if we take a look at the second pasuk of the parsha, that's Bamidbar Perek Lamed Pasuk Gimel. The chapter actually started at the end of Parshas Pinchas, because, as we have seen, whoever ended the chapters, divided the chapters, did not really know how to learn Chumash, and therefore chapter and verse is convenient for us, but it's not really our religion. So the second pasuk of the parsha, Ish ki yidon neder l'Hashem, oh, ishava shivua le sorry saral nafsho. If a person takes a neder or a shivua, and there's a number of differences between them, but by and large they are to render certain things forbidden for him. Lo yachel devaro. Now, what is the meaning of lo yachel devaro? If we were to translate it, so the word yachel could be connected to the word chulin, which is mundane. The Gemara states that if there is a basis for Hataras Nadarim, it's in these words, Lo Yachel Devaro. For the Gemara states, Hu Eino Mochel, Hu Eino Mechel, he cannot undo his neder. Aval Acherim Mochlimna, but others can. So the pasuk is telling you that if you make a neder, if someone makes a neder, he cannot undo it. But the inference is, well, he may not be able to undo it. Others can. And that's that. Now, what's very interesting is, I don't know if this, how to rate this question, but as drushes go, that doesn't sound too bad, if we may comment. That's okay. It's a straight inference. He can't make it mutter, meaning somebody else can. Is there any other halacha in the Torah that is darshan from an inference? Plenty. And from less than an inference. And that's all called midah shatorah nedreshes bahen. And that's called darshaning the psukim. So in a sense, we're in a bit of an unusual situation. Because this was the much vaunted, floating in the air halacha that, you know, it doesn't really have a basis in Torah Shebichtav. It is pure Torah Shebapeh. But when finally the source was forthcoming, it doesn't sound too bad at all. If I didn't know better, or if I didn't know worse, I would rate it as a standard drasha. So what's wrong with it? And why do we insist that Heter Nedarim is Porchim Ba'avir? It's all Porchim Ba'avir. It's also interesting to note, and we have to pay very close attention here, that the nusach of the Gemara is Hu Eino Mechel, right? He cannot make it permitted, Aval Acherim Mochlim Lo, but others can be Mochel for him. And that's a very interesting drift a little bit, because Lo Yachel didn't seem to be from an expression of Mechila, of forgiveness, of saying it's okay, of pardon. But by the time we got to the Beis Din, we said, he has lo yachel, but others can be mochel for him. How did the word itself shift from yachel to mechila? Now, it's very important for all of our familiarity with Hataras Nedarim to be aware that Hataras Nedarim, it requires a Beis Din, as we know, needs a panel of three. But the Hataras Nedarim itself is not called din. In other words, what is a Beis Din? A Beis Din are judges. What do judges do? Judge. Hataras Nedarim is not an act of judgment. And evidence of that is that Hataras Nedarim can be performed at night. There is a principle in halacha that din can never certainly commence and can never happen at night. Beis Din only sits during the day. For purposes of Hataras Nedarim, it can be performed day, night, doesn't make a difference. And that means that it isn't din. Whatever's happening is something that is not within the profile of judgment that is restricted to the day. Interestingly, coming back to Kol Nidre, where, as we mentioned, that is a Hataras Nedarim at heart. So the irony of Kol Nidre is that although for many people it defines the night of Yom Kippur, it actually cannot take place during the night of Yom Kippur at all. That's why it happens before Shkia, because Hataras Nedarim has to be early. But why? Not because it can't happen at night. There is no restriction for Hataras Nedarim happening at night, but because it can't take place on Shabbos or Yom Tov. Hataras Nedarim is something that is off limits for Shabbos and Yom Tov. So It's a great irony that Kol Nidre is so not part of Yom Kippur that it's actually halachically barred from being part of Yom Kippur, and that's why Yom Kippur starts 20 minutes earlier for Kol Nidre, before Yom Kippur actually comes in. But it's an issue of Yom Kippur being Yom Tov. It's not a question of not going into the night, per se. So whatever Hataras Nedarim is, it doesn't have the profile of an act of judgment, per se. And the truth of the matter is, here we have to ask a very sensitive question, and please, no sudden moves until the end. If we say, and it's clear, and it's not a secret, that Hataras Nedarim isn't an act of judgment, then now we have to ask the question, though the panel that is Matir the Neder, are they really Dayanim? Are they a Beis Din? Are they an ad hoc Beis Din? Or not? Now, we do find that the Beis Din sometimes presides over things that aren't actually judgment per se. Chalitza and Geirus actually, and a number of other things, needs the presence of a Beis Din not to render judgment, but to ratify it. And therefore it could be that Hataras Nedarim, it might not be din, an act of judgment, but it needs a Beis Din. However, there is ample grounds to posit that the people that perform Hataras Nedarim are not considered to be a Beis Din at all. If they were, by the way, being promoted to the Beis Din was never easier, because all you do is you get three people together and they become your Beis Din. But the halacha is, and again, it's halacha lemaisa, it is possible for two people who are related to each other to sit on the same panel to annul someone's neder. Now, if we know anything about a Beis Din, we know that none of the members of the Beis Din can ever be related to each other or related to the person that they are treating or judging. However, the halacha is, when it comes to Hataras Nedarim, you can have relatives sitting on the same panel, you can have relatives being matir each other's neder, it's mutar lechatchila. And that would seem to indicate very clearly that, strictly speaking, they're not really a Beis Din at all. They're called a Beis Din in the sense that that's how one petitions them. Shimuno Rabosai, Dayani Mumchim, they're called a Beis Din, but that in a sense is a reference to the fact that they are performing some type of ratifying act for the person. But strictly speaking, they don't have the status of Dayanim at all. And what's interesting is, and this is discussed by Rabbi Tzalo Zolti Zatzal, the Rav of Yerushalayim, and the Sefer Mishnas Yavetz, support for this idea, we're used to calling them a Beis Din, but support for the idea that this is not an act of Beis Din at all, is if one takes a look at the very beginning of Maseches Sanhedrin. You open up the Gemara, you can't miss the first Mishnah. It is the entire first page, is the opening Mishnah of Sanhedrin. And the opening Mishnah goes through every area of Din and everything that needs a Beis Din, how many members of the Beis Din does it need? And that's how it begins. Dinei Mamonos, monetary matters, Bishlosha, and this needs 3, and this needs 5, and capital cases need 23, and some things need the Sanhedrin Gedola. And it goes through the entire spectrum of possible areas that a Beis Din will be needed, how many are required for that Beis Din. Says the Mishnas Yavetz, it's most interesting to note that there is no reference there to Hataras Nedarim. She'elat tam, simple shaila. Of all the things, someone should have said, Hataras Nedarim Bishlosha. Says Mishnas Yavetz, the omission of nullification of vows from that opening Mishnah of things that need a Beis Din is further confirmation that actually they are not really functioning as a Beis Din at all. But if that's true, then now we need to ask a question, so what are they? If these three people are not a Beis Din, you can call them Dayanim, but they're not really Dayanim, so what are they? And what exactly is their contribution to Hataras Nedarim? It's not an act of judgment. They're not judges anyway. So what are they? What's their yichus here? Now, to answer all of this, we need to consult a short section of the Mishnah Torah of the Rambam. In Hilchos Shavuos, Perek Vav Halacha Beis, the Rambam discusses the background to Hataras Nedarim. And let us pay attention to every word, because this will be the key for us. In Halacha Aleph of the sixth Perek, he's discussed briefly Hataras Nedarim, what it is and how it works. And then in Halacha Beis, says the Rambam, V'davar zeh, ein lo ikar klal b'torah shebichtav. This concept of nullifying vows has no basis at all, klal, at all, in Torah shebichtav, in the written Torah. Ela, kach lomdu mi Moshe Rabbeinu mi piha Kabbalah. This was learned from Moshe, from tradition that he had received. Shezeh ha-kosuv, lo yachel devaro, which is where it all somehow is hovering around these words, lo yachel devaro, means shelo yichalel hu ba'atzmo deruch kalus rosh b'sha'at nefesh. Lo yachel devaro means that he should not degrade his vow. According to the Rambam, the word lo yachel, which is a person's standing relationship with their neder, is he cannot degrade it. He's forbidden from treating it flippantly. Ki'inyan shene'emar, analogous to the words of the pasuk elsewhere, v'chilalta eshem elokecha. Says the Rambam, if you wish to know what is at the root of the word lo yachel, it's from the word chilul, meaning profanation, degradation. Like we would say chilul Hashem, v'lo yichalel Hashem Elokav. Aval im nichem v'chozabo chacham matula. If he regrets it and wishes to retract, the chacham will nullify it for him. What is the meaning of these words of the Rambam? Says Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, we see from the Rambam that the way that Hataras Nedarim works, the way that undoing your neder works, is not that it was forbidden, and then the Beis Din somehow had the ability to take that which was forbidden and make it mutter for you. As some courts of law work that way. A Jewish court of law should not work that way. If something is forbidden, they have to tell you it's forbidden, not tell you it's permitted. And all of a sudden, they receive this power that they can take something that's forbidden and make it mutter for you. How is that true? The answer is that the Torah has told the person who took a neder or a shvua that he is bound and restricted by it, because if he violates it, that means that he's degrading his word. But if he petitions the Beis Din, so petitioning the Beis Din to help him out is an expression of the fact that he is not taking it lightly. He is not unilaterally violating his word. He's expressing his regret to others, either a yochid, an expert, individual, or a panel of three. And all of that is an expression of the fact that he is not taking his neder lightly. Once that's true, that he's not taking his neder lightly, as expressed by him having gone out of his way to petition these people to help him out, the Torah says it's mutter. But all of that is contained within lo yachel devaro. I think we will appreciate, it's a delicate point, but it's clear from all, everything that we've said. This is not a drosha at all. Lo yachel devaro is not an inference, as if to say, he can't do it, but others can. If the word yachel meant to render permitted, so then that would be a straight inference. He can't make it permitted, others can. That would be a very good drasha. But the word yachel doesn't come from the word chol, which means permitted, which is a rather benign word. It comes from the word chilul, which means degradation. He cannot degrade his neder. So let's ask the question, can someone else degrade his neder? No one can degrade his neder. So there's no inference here. The pasuk isn't saying what we're forbidding for him is mutter for someone else to do. No one's allowed to degrade his neder. It's a holy thing. But rather what we're saying is contained within he should not degrade his neder is a Kabbalah, which is a tremendous chiddush, that if he petitions three people to annul it for him, he is considered to be on the safe side of not having degraded his neder. He's been yotze yidei chova lo yachel devaro. And that is why the Gemara says in Chagiga, Heter nedarim porchim ba'avir. They float in the air. There is no drasha for it. And that is also why, and this is again a delicate point, when we consult the pasuk of Lo Yachel, so the Gemara says, Hu eino meichel, right? He can't do that. Aval acherim mochlim lo. Other people can pardon him. Now, the word Yachel has nothing to do with mechila, but it's not an inference. And therefore, this is the practical expression. As long as he goes to others, they can be mochel for him. We should know, by the way, the term mechila does not appear anywhere in Tanakh as an expression of forgiveness. We're used to it as part of the triumvirate of slicha, kapara, and mechila. But in the Lashon of Tanakh, there is never a reference to mechila, only to slicha and kapara. There is no way, therefore, that a drasha can be based on the word mechila, because the Torah doesn't recognize, as far as we're concerned, the expression of mechila. But rather, acherim mochlim lo doesn't mean that that's what the word lo yachel means. It means he can't degrade it. If he goes to others, they can pardon him for it, and he's considered not to have degraded it. So these, I believe, are very fundamental insights into the institution that we call Hataras Nedarim, and an amazing situation whereby what looks like a simple, straightforward reading of the Pasuk is actually a great deal more.
So you're saying that Yachel and Mochel have nothing to do with each other?
That's correct.
That's important.
Now, let's move on from Nedarim and Hataras Nedarim to the war with Midian. And once again, try and pay as close attention as we can to the Psukim. So the war with Midian is in Perek Lamed Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe l'mor, nekom nikmas b'nei Yisrael me'eis ha-Midyanim. Exact the vengeance of b'nei Yisrael from the Midyanim for everything they did with regards to enticing the b'nei Yisrael for Znus. Pasuk Gimel. Vayidaber Moshe l'am l'mor, hechatzume etchem anashim l'tzava. Release, send forward men for the army. V'yu al Midyan l'seis nikmas Hashem b'Midyan. Okay, how many people went? Let us read carefully. We're not hurrying through. Pasuk Dalet. Elef lamateh, elef lamateh, lechol matos Yisrael tishlechu latzava. So, if we want to know how many people went from each tribe, now we know. The answer is elef lamateh, elef lamateh. The question now is, how many is that? And the reason why it's a question is because, as we have seen, actually not too long ago, there is a machlokus between different schools amongst the Tanoim as to what to make of repetitions in the Torah. Do we say, Dibra Torah, Koloshim B'nei Adam? The Torah, as far as repetitions are concerned, repeats the way, Lahavdil, but the way a person would repeat, and therefore it doesn't mean to add any additional numbers. So if it says ish, ish, it just means anyone. It doesn't mean two people. Or do we say, no, lo divra Torah kolashim ne'adam. A person may repeat in that way. But if the Torah repeats, it's to add. We saw it with respect to the Meraglin. Ish echad, lemate avosav tishlachu. And there we saw there's actually a machlokus, again in the Tanoim, as to whether one was sent from each tribe or two. And the Sifrei tells us that there is a parallel debate with regards to our pasuk. Elef lamateh, elef lamateh. According to Rabbi Yishmael, says the Sifrei, 2,000 went from each. Because each elef lamateh is another 1,000. Whereas Rabbi Akiva says, no, Dibra Torah Kalashim B'nei Adam, and elef lamateh means 1,000 per tribe, giving you a total of 12,000. Now, that's a very interesting machlokas. What makes it also interesting is that if we just read another two lines of the parsha, it sounds like it is impossible to have a machlokas about this. For the next pasuk states, "Vayimasru mealfei Yisrael elef lamateh, shnei masar elef chalutei tzava." The next pasuk says, "From Bnei Yisrael came 12,000." And if that's the case, it doesn't really sound like there's any room to say, Elef Lamateh. Elef Lamateh means 2,000, because that would give you a total of 24. But the pasuk tells you, black on white, that the total was 12,000. It seems clear corroboration of the view of Rabbi Akiva. But the Netziv explains in his Perush to the Sifrei, Emekah Netziv, that if we look closely at the pasuk, we'll understand how Rabbi Yishmael views the pasuk. For as we know, there are a number of roles that one can play going out to war. There is the combatant role, but there is a great deal of support and supply and auxiliary and tactical. And therefore, Rabbi Yishmael will understand that there were indeed 2,000 from each tribe, giving a total of 24,000 that went out. The pasuk says 12,000 went out. Says the Netziv, if we read the pasuk, it states, 12,000 chalutzei tzava, 12,000 went out to the battle, to fight. But for each 1,000 that went out to fight, there was another 1,000 who was providing all of that broader support and assistance. That is how the pasuk would look for Rabbi Yishmael. What's interesting is, we haven't finished. Because 12,000 perhaps is 12 out of 24,000. But there's more. For if we go back to Pasuk Dalet, it states, Elef lamate, Elef lamate, okay, 1,000 per mate, Lechol matos Yisrael, for all of the tribes. Who is all of the tribes? Says Rashi, Lerabos, to include Shevet Levi. Kol matos Yisrael means everyone. Okay. Who does everyone mean? Everyone, including Shevet Levi. The problem is, and this question is asked by the Mizrahi, once Kol matos Yisrael includes Shevet Levi, we're going to have another problem when we go back to the pasuk which tells us that 12,000 went to war. Because now we should no longer be 12, but Shevet Levi are also involved. It should be 13,000, aside from the ones who are offering support. But how, why is it 12? If Levi are involved, it should be 13. The Bnei Yisrael are considered to be 12 Shvatim even without Levi. So when Levi comes in, why is it 12 Ela? And the Mizrahi says something most interesting. And that is, we're very used to the idea that Shevet Yosef splits up into two, Menashe and Ephraim. So they're not one, but they're two. Says Mizrahi, that's not always true. When do we say that Shevet Yosef is actually two Shvatim? Or when would we perhaps consider them to be really one Shevet called Yosef? What does it depend on? Says Mizrahi, Ephraim and Manasseh are two separate Shvatim with regards to anything that relates to their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. And what's interesting is, the Gemara states this in Maseches Horios and Daf Vav Amud Beis, based on a pasuk, which when Yaakov originally turns them into two shvatim back in Parshas Vayechi, so he says, Al Shem Achehem Yikaru Benachalasam, they will be on a par with their brothers, meaning they have Shevet status, Benachalasam, with anything that relates to their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, anytime you will see Menashe and Ephraim being considered separate Shvatim, that is a point on the vector that is leading them towards realizing their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. It could be with the Meraglim, because the Meraglim is about entering Eretz Yisrael, and therefore both Menashe and Ephraim have their own Meragel. It could be with regards to the Degolim, which are also encamping in preparation for Machanos, amongst other things, for war. And therefore, Degel, Machane, Ephraim, and Menashe have different degolim. However, when we come to our Parsha, the war against Midian has nothing to do with getting closer to realizing their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. It is a detour from that vector. It has a different form entirely, a different goal entirely. And that, as is stated by the Pasuk, is Loseis es nikmas Hashem b'midyan, is to exact and express the vengeance of Hashem for them having brought the Jewish people down to the Madrega of the Znus that they did, and this is a reaction to that, but it brings them no closer. It has nothing to do with getting their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore, says the Mizrahi, in this instance, Shevet Yosef is called Yosef. Without Shevet Levi, there would only be 11 tribes. And that is why, when you bring in Shevet Levi, there are Shneim Asar Elef. And these words of the Mizrahi are very interesting because they are identifying a most unique nature of this war. It has very little in common with any of the other wars that we know. It's not defense per se, it's not Kibush Haaretz, it is entirely a local reaction to that disaster that took place there. Laseis es nikmas Hashem b'midyan. And it's very interesting to point out that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky also arrived at a similar conclusion, that this war is a unique war. And this will be expressed in other ways as well. Firstly, the very presence of Levi in the army already should point to the fact that it's an unusual situation. Shevet Levi never goes to war. But here they did. L'rabba Shevet Levi. And the reason why is because this is a response to the profanation that had taken place within B'nai Yisrael. The reaction to that chilul here, to that profanation, is to restore the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and therefore they need to be represented by Shevet Levi as well. If there's any war that you would ever expect to see Levi in that war, it's this war. L'aseis nikmas Hashem b'midyan. It is about matters spiritual. It's not about matters temporal. It's not even about Eretz Yisrael, in which the Levim have lo nachala. And what's most amazing is to see, the more attention we pay to detail, the richer comes out the message. There's something else. Rabbi Yaakov says, in his own unique way, if we look through Tanakh, we will see that these divisions within the army always become groups of 50. The standard unit within the army, as far as the Tanakh is concerned, is 50. We find, for example, in Shmuel Aleph, when the Jewish people first request a king, and that was considered to be a little bit early, and Shmuel is trying to put them off a little bit. And he tells them, you asked for it, we'll guess what you might get. If you ask for a king, he could take your children, he'll take you to the army, even maybe for his own purposes, right? He'll bring you to his army. Is that what you want? Shmuel's words are, Velasum lo sarei alafim v'sarei chamishim. Interesting, as he's describing the king's army, he puts them into grand units of 1,000 and subunits of 50, because that's what the army looks like. In the beginning of Malachim Beis, when Eliyahu is in hiding, Ahaziel, Melech Yisrael, sends soldiers to look for him. But the pasuk states, "Vayishlach elav sar chamishim v'chamushav." He sent an officer of 50. And in fact, Rabbi Yaakov goes so far as to suggest that this may even be connected to the way the Jewish people originally came out of Mitzrayim, ready for war. Yotzim biyad rama. It says v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. V'chamushim is related to chamishim, because they came out organized in that way. And that's what the army looks like. And that is why Rabbi Yaakov says, if we take a look last week in Parshas Pinchas, at the Shvatim, we will find that every Shevet ends off either in an increment of 100 or of 50, which is interesting. There are no loose ends. There's no 101 or 2 or 3. Rabbi Yaakov understands that this count as well, which is Erev, entry into Eretz Canaan, is organizing them in those units. And therefore, even if there were some loose numbers or some odd men, they would just be attached to a unit of 50, and therefore the increments are those of 50s and 100s, which is a chiddush. The only exception is Shevet Reuven, whose numbers end in 30. They are the only exception. And the reason why they are an exception is because Shevet Reuven deliberately has a unit that is deficient to remember Dothan and Aviram. That's why when the Torah tells us to count, it gives us a recap about the story of Dothan and Aviram in last week's parsha. In the middle of the numbers, all of a sudden we sit down and we remember Dothan and Aviram, what happened, and then they were swallowed up. And then the pasuk says, Vayula Nes. And they were as a nes, Rashi says. Nes is a banner. Laos ulzikaron, as a remembrance. Says Rabbi Yaakov, what's the remembrance? The answer is, this is the remembrance. That's why this tribe will end with an increment of 30, as opposed to any other tribe. It's to remember. That's the os, that deficient unit. But all of the that's the exception, and all of the others are 50s. And whenever you have an army, you will find an army of, the units are chamishim. Says Rabbi Yaakov, I mean, we're not used to learning chumash in this way. But there's one exception. And that's this week's parsha, Parshas Matos. Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Let us see what happens. They've come back from battle. Moshe is upset about a couple of things, and that's a whole sugya in itself. Pasuk Yudalit Vayiktzof Moshe, he gets angry. Al Pekudei Achayil, on the officers. Sarei Ha'alafim, V'sarei Hameos, Haba'im Mitzvah Melchama, says Rabbi Yaakov. That's a kasha on me, because I have just established, looking through the Tanakh, that the units in the Torah, in a war, will always be a 50. We would have expected Sarei Alafim V'Sarei Chamishim, but the Pasuk actually refers to Sarei Hameos. How do we deal with that? Says Rabbi Yaakov, the reason why the units in that war were divided into 100 is because the division of 100 is the appropriate division for matters of Kedusha. Further on in the Sefer Malachim, there is a king called Yoash. A member of his family is looking to wipe out all of her relatives. And Yoash, who's a young child, is left, and he is hidden by the Kohen Gadol, Yehoyada HaKohen. This is in Malachim Beis, Perek Yud Aleph. And Yehoyada convenes a meeting and has Yoash hidden away in the Beis HaMikdash for a number of years until he eventually became king, Yoash HaMelech. Says the Pasuk, Shalach Yehoyada Vayikach Esarei Hameos. He convened a meeting and all of the leaders got together. They are called Sarei Hameos. What do we see from here? The Kohanim were also divided into groups of 100, and their leaders were Sarei Hameos. Says Rabbi Yaakov, and now, when it comes to matters military, the units are those of 50, Sar Hamishim, as we saw. When it comes to matters of sanctity, the units are those of 100. And there's one point where the two will meet, and that is the war in Parshas Matos. Because this war was not for temporal gain in any way. It was entirely Kedusha generated. Laseis es nikmas Hashem v'midyan. If you could use the term advisedly, it was a holy war. That's why Levi came out, and they never go out to war. And that's why, says Rabbi Yaakov, the units for this war were divided according to Dovah Shebi Kedusha, not according to Dovah Shebatzava. And that is amazing. That way of sweeping through first the Chumash and then the Nevi'im, to that these nuances really attain new dimensions. So this is all corroborated by the Mizrahi, who says that in this, with regards to this war, Menashe and Ephraim, coming back to the Mizrahi, they're one, they coalesce, they are Shevet Yosef, because this isn't about entering Eretz Yisrael, this is an entirely unique type of war, and they are one Shevet, Levi becomes the 12th Shevet. And in fact, the Maharal in the Gur Ariyeh suggests that a very simple answer to this question as to why, if Levi also sent 1,000 men, why are there 12,000, not 13,000? It may very well be, says the Mizrahi, that the Gur Ariyeh, that the Levim didn't go out to fight. they went out to be a presence of Hashem's chosen Shevet in the war. Because the more Kedusha you have in the war, the more successful it would be, especially in a war which is about reinstating the Kedusha of Bnei Yisrael. And that's why the Pasuk tells us that when they went out, they took the Oren with them, and they took the Tzitz with them, the Tzitz of the Kohen Gadol. When does that ever go out to war? All of the accoutrements of Kedusha are brought into this war in order to reestablish the balance of Kedusha. And therefore Levi are also there, but not necessarily fighting. 13,000 went out. Of those 13,000, 12,000 are Chalutzei Tzava, and there's another 1,000 that are there in a similar capacity to the Oron and to the Tzitz. And what's most fascinating is the Toldos Adam, which is a perush on the Sifrei, explains that this may also be what is behind coming back to the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Yishmael understands that actually there were no less than 24,000 that went out, and not the 12,000. 1,000 people it's a lot to provide support for the 1,000 that are fighting. It seems that it's important that there be such a large number, not much larger, but at least to have crossed a critical point. And what are we to make of that? It says the Toldos Adam, there is a statement of the Talmud in Maseches Yevamos, Daf Samach Dalet Omer Aleph. And the Gemara says, Ein Hashchina Shora, the divine presence does not dwell, Al Pochos Mi Kaf Beis Elef Mi Yisrael, on less than 22,000 of Yisrael. And it's based actually on the pasuk that we say in the davening, when we put the Sefer Torah back, Uvenucho Yomar, Shuvah Hashem, Rivavos, Alfi Yisrael, Shuvah Hashem, let the Shechina descend on Rivavos, right, which is 2 myriad, 20,000, Alfe, which is 2,000, that's the 22,000. Now, of course, as we have been reminded in this century, everything is relative. Namely, that when we say that Shechina requires 22,000, that's one statement of the Gemara. Elsewhere, we'll be told that, as soon as you have a minion together, then the Shechina is already there. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos will tell you that as soon as you have two people who are sharing Divrei Torah, the Shechina is there. So, of course, it's a question of degrees. But there is a certain critical level of Hashras HaShechina that is crossed with Kaf Beis Elef Mi Yisrael. Rivavos Alfei Yisrael, says the Toldos Adam, it may well be that is why the Torah insisted that for this war to be as successful as it was, and as we see, there were no casualties, which is unbelievable, because there were ultimately only 12,000 fighting, and there were no casualties. That is absolutely a question of zechus, and in order to have maximum zechus, they need to have crossed the threshold of Rivavos Alfei Yisrael. So instead of sending just the 12,000, it was doubled to 24 in order to cross them over to have that level of Gilushkin. So these are very important perspectives on this most unique war within our history, Loseis Nikmas Hashem Bemidja. Now, one of the people who meets his comeuppance here in this week's Parsha is Bilam. And let us see exactly what happens there. Rashi talks about it. Let's see the pasuk first. Perek Lamed Aleph. Pasuk Ches. Ves Malchi Midian Hargua Chalaleihem. They killed the kings of Midian. Es Evi, Ves Rekem, Ves Tzur, Ves Chur, Ves Reva, Chameshes Malchi Midian. So they killed those five kings. And then and they killed Bilam as well. What's Bilam doing in the middle of a war zone? Last we heard of him, he went home. The Pasuk says, Vayasha Bilam Ayomu Limkomo. Say Chazal, yes, he went home, quoted in Rashi, but he came back. He came back for his fee. Because he'd been a bitter disappointment in terms of his cursing of Bnei Yisrael, but he scored a success with his Eitzah to get the Jewish people to sin. And even though no one had offered him to pay, it's quite clear to him that he only has to show up and they will show their gratitude. As it is, by the time he came back to meet the war against Midian. And there's a very interesting Rashi. What's most interesting about it is Rashi gives us the background to the death of Bilam. And as far as we're concerned, there should be no background. Because Rashi is explaining, this is why Bilam got killed. This is why they killed Bilam, as we will see. From our perspective, Bilam is the biggest villain in this entire Chumash. He should be killed on sight. But as Mefarshi Rashi point out, it is quite possible that those that went to war were not aware of Bilam's role or involvement in any of this. There was never any direct contact between Bilam and them. The most that may have happened is that if one of them lifted up their eyes, they would have seen two people on a hilltop somewhere on the horizon, and one of them happened to be Bilam. But they're not aware, not of the background and not of his involvement. Which means that when they finally met him, it may have been something else that got him killed. And this was it. Says Rashi, Bilam halach sham litol sachar 24,000 shehipel mi Yisrael. He went to collect the bounty for those 24,000 that were killed as a result of his counsel. V'yotzam imidyan likros Yisrael, and he left Midian to meet Yisrael. Umasian eitzar ra'a, and he gave them bad advice. What's the bad advice? Amar lahem. He said, listen, im kishi yisem shishim ribo lo yucholtem lahem. When you were a group together of 600,000, you were no match for them, because they still took 24,000 from you. V'achshav b'yud beis elef atem barim lehiloche. And now, you're coming to wage war against them just with 12,000? Nosnu lo scharu mishalam v'lo kipchu. So they gave him his reward, and they killed him. It's a very obscure-sounding Rashi. Here's Bilam. He's looking to dissuade them, because he's saying, listen, you don't have a chance. And they responded by killing him. What exactly is the attraction between what Bilam is saying to them and their response of killing him? The truth is, the Maharal has a more basic question. And that is, what does Bilam want more than anything else? What does signify success for him? The more Jews that are killed, the better for Bilam. So it's very interesting that Bilam here takes the role of trying to dissuade them from what is really a suicidal mission for them. On the contrary, if he really thinks it's true, so he shouldn't say anything. If he really thinks that they have no chance, so there's another 12,000 that just went to their doom. Why are you stopping them? That's a good shayla. All of a sudden, he became a good citizen. He only wants what's best for them. What, that they should avoid danger? On the contrary, if he thinks it's dangerous, so say nothing, bleib stumm, and they'll go to their deaths. Says the Maharal, what we see from here is that Bilam doesn't think they're in danger. He actually thinks that if they wage war, they'll be successful. But if that's true, then why is he saying they don't have a chance? Because Bilam, who understands these things very well, knows that their success in a war like this, there's only 12,000, they're all tzaddikim, they've got the tzitz, and they've got the aron, and they've got Shevet Levi, it is dependent on their spiritual status, and specifically on their bitochon. If Bilam can undermine their bitochon, then they really are at risk. And therefore, he actually believes that they'll succeed. He told them that they have no chance because he wants them to fail. And therefore, he wants them to believe him that they have no chance. Because if they believe him, then they really will fail. That's what's behind Bilam. It's Bilam until the end. And says Maharal, that's why they killed him. They killed him first and foremost because he is a threat to their survival. Because if he succeeds in lowering their morale, he will endanger all of them. And therefore, he had to be eliminated even before the war even began. And that was the end of Bilam. There is a very interesting section of the Gemara in Perek Chelek, final Perek of Sanhedrin, where someone asked Rabbi Chanina, how old was Bilam when he died? So Rabbi Chanina said, I don't know for sure, but I can estimate. Because the Pasuk states in Tehillim, Vata Elokim Toridem Lever Shachas, Anshe Domimu Mirma, Lo Yechatsuya Mehem, Vani Eftachbach. People who are deceitful, people of blood, Lo Yechatsuya Mehem, they won't even live out half of their days. So, Yemeshino Seinu Vahem Shivim Shana, if we take a person's normal lifespan at 70, Lo Yechatsuya Mehem means they wouldn't reach 35, not even half. So I would say 34, 33, 34, something like that. That's how he responded. And this person said that he checked the records and he found that that was exactly how old Bilam was. 33. Yep. What's interesting is, there is another statement of the Gemara, which talks about, well, the words of the Gemara are, Shlosha hayu ba'osa etza. Rashi explains, when Paro originally is having his council how to deal with the Jewish problem. So there were three that were on that panel. They were Bilam, Yisro, and Eov. And each of them responded differently, and each of them was treated differently. Bilam gave an Eitzah to persecute, and he was killed. Yisro ran away. That was his protest. Ran away. Refused to be part of it. And his schar was that his descendants sat on the Sanhedrin. And the Gemara brings the pasuk to show that was the case. Eov, who kept quiet, so he had Yisurei Eov, because keeping quiet isn't always the solution. At least Yisro registered some form of protest by running away. He couldn't topple the government, but he didn't want to be part of it, even tacitly. Now what's interesting is, that Eitzah of Paro, what to do with the Jewish people, took place certainly before the birth of Moshe, which is approximately 120 years prior to this event. And if that's the case, then our question is, how can we say that Bilam was 33 when he died, if Bilam was part of the Eitzah that took place 120 years before? Which is a good shaila. And we should know, there are those we've shown him who understand that these are agodas chalukos, meaning these are two traditions, they cannot be reconciled, and that happens sometimes. But there is no reconciliation between them. 33 and 123 are not the same thing. We should know, however, interestingly, that one of the Balei HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Menachem, explains that when the Gemara says, Shlosha hayu ba'osa etza, there were three who were originally part of a council as to what to do with the Jewish people, there's three that were consulted, the Eitzah that the Gemara is talking about is not the Eitzah of Paro all those years ago. It's the Eitzah of Bilam. What to do with Lecha i'otzecha Eisa shetase Lecha hamazeh b'achar sayomim. It's the Eitzah of Benos Midian. It's the elders of Midian, and Yisro was ultimately one of the elders of Midian, went back to Midian at that time, and they were all together, Bilam, Eov, and Yisro ran away. That's when we say Yisro ran, Eov was silent, and Bilam was the one that gave the Eitzah, says Rabbeinu Menachem, and that is why there is no contradiction between Shlosh Shahayu Ba'osa Eitzah and the age of 33, because the Eitzah took place a few days ago, or a few weeks ago, not 120 years ago, and Bilam is 33. And by the way, I think that may explain to us why the Gemara says that Yisro's Sachar was that his descendants sat on the Sanhedrin, which is very nice. But if you'd have asked me what I thought his Sachar was, I probably would have said his Sachar was that his son-in-law was Moshe Rabbeinu, who as one individual who is the equivalent of the entire Sanhedrin. So it seems to be rather low-key, except according to Rabbeinu Menachem, his good deed of running away happened after Moshe was already his son-in-law. So what else? What was his Sachar for that? In any case. So these are some of the approaches of the Rishonim. We should mention, with reservations, but there is room for a further approach. It is possible that the reason why there is no contradiction between Bilam being in the panel 120 years ago and Bilam being 33, and you can't be 33 and 123 at the same time, comes from a different direction. We know that Chazal, the way they express themselves in the Agoda, is very often non-literal. We spoke about this with the battle between Og, Melech HaBoshan, and the Jewish people. And the reason why is that there are certain ideas that are presented in order to get their concept across, even if they're not to be taken literally. They're to be taken accurately, but not always literally. According to some, part of that way of expression is that there, if Chazal will speak as a, in mashal, really, in mashal, that's how the Rambam expresses it, they speak in analogy, in metaphor, then sometimes they can use people as mashalim, as if to say that they can refer to a certain character in the Tanakh, but he is a mashal because he is the avtipus, he is the prototype for someone else actually that they have in mind. And this is something that we've mentioned on another occasion when the Toras Kohanim tells us that Rabbi Akiva explained the pasuk in Bechukosai, which says, in the Tochacha, v'shavarti es ga'on uzchem, I will break the pride of your strength. And Rabbi Akiva says, that is a reference to Yoav ben Tseruya. Yoav is the deputy of, or is the general of David. And al pnei hadvarim, ma'inyan Yoav ben Tseruya, of all the people to talk about, why is he the pride of their strength? Rabbi Reuven Margolius in the Sefer Olalos explains that Rabbi Akiva is not talking about Yoav ben Tseruya. He's talking about Shimon ben Kochba, whose history was parallel to that of Yoav. Originally on the right track, very successful, made some serious errors, deteriorated, ended up being killed himself. It wasn't always possible to openly speak about those that you were referring to. At a time just post the Roman revolt, to give a public hesped for Bar Kochba was not always feasible. But to talk about Yoav ben Tseruya, and anyone who's there understands that if you're crying over Yoav ben Tseruya, you're crying over somebody else. Who is Yoav ben Tseruya? Who is that character type? Lahavdil, but at a certain point of Chizuk, Gedolei Hadoros, in their droshos and in their sichos, when they talk about the problems of the time, they talk about it in prototypes of Achashverosh and Esav and Korach. Every generation has its Achashverosh, and every generation has its Korach, and every generation has its Bilam. The Bilam in the time of the Gemara was Oso Aish. There were those who suggest that when they're asking the question, how old was Bilam when he died, the reference is to Yeshu HaNotzri, who was 33 when he died. And it was not possible to talk about it openly in that way. And by the way, the one who asked Rabbi Hanina, how old do you think he was? And he answered 23. He says, I checked the records and you're right. How does someone in the time of Rabbi Hanina have access to records from Midian, which who knows what they were written on and how they survived? They're recent records. And this is an idea which certainly in principle is well reasoned. Of course, in application one needs guidance, but this is a possibility that the number suggests to relate to what seems to be a stira between Bilam having been alive already the time before Moshe Rabbeinu and Bilam being 33 at the time that he's killed. We'll leave it over there for this evening.